be seek. Then again, let's be honest, it might just as easily be hide. Over the last months in Italy, my word has largely been pleasure, but that word doesn't match every single part of me, or I wouldn't be so eager to get myself to India. My word might be devotion, though this makes me sound like more of a goody-goody than I actually am, and doesn't take into account how much wine I've been drinking. I don't know the answer, and I suppose that's what this year of journeying is about, finding my word. But one thing I can say with all assurance, it ain't sex. Or so I claim, anyhow. You tell me, then, why today my feet led me, almost of their own accord, to a discreet boutique off the Via Condotte, where, under the expert tutelage of the silky young Italian shopgirl, I spent a few dreamy hours and a transcontinental airline ticket's worth of money, buying enough lingerie to keep a sultan's consort outfitted for 1,001 nights. I bought bras of every shape and formation. I bought filmy, flimsy camisoles and sassy bits of panty in every color of the Easter basket, and slips that came in creamy satins and hush-now baby silks, and handmade little bits of string and dings, and basically just one velvety, lacy, crazy Valentine after another. I have never owned things like this in my life, so why now? As I was walking out of the store, hauling my cache of tissue-wrapped naughties under my arm, I suddenly thought of the anguished demand I'd heard a Roman soccer fan yell the other night at the Lazio game, when Lazio's star player, Albertini, at a critical moment had passed the ball right into the middle of nowhere, for no reason whatsoever, totally blowing the play. "Per chi?" the fan had shouted in near madness. "Per chi? For whom? For whom are you passing this ball, Albertini? Nobody's there." Out on the street after my delirious hours of lingerie shopping, I remembered this line and repeated it to myself in a whisper. Per chi? For whom, Liz? For whom all this decadent sexiness? Nobody's there. I only had a few weeks left in Italy and absolutely no intention of knocking boots with anyone. Or did I? Had I finally been affected by the word on the streets in Rome? Was this some final effort to become Italian? Was this a gift to myself? Or was it a gift for some as-of-yet not-even-imagined lover? Was this an attempt to start healing my libido after the sexual self-confidence disaster of my last relationship? I asked myself, you gonna bring all this stuff to India? 34. Luca Spaghetti's birthday falls this year on America's Thanksgiving Day, so he wants to do a turkey for his birthday party. He's never eaten a big, fat, roasted American Thanksgiving turkey, though he's seen them in pictures. He thinks it should be easy to replicate such a feast, especially with the help of me, a real American. He says we can use the kitchen of his friends Mario and Simona, who have a nice big house in the mountains outside Rome, and who always host Luca's birthday parties. So here was Luca's plan for the festivities. He would pick me up at around 7 o'clock at night after he'd finished work, and then we would drive north out of Rome for an hour or so to his friend's house, where we would meet the other attendees of the birthday party, and we'd drink some wine and all get to know each other, and then, probably around 9 p.m., we would commence to roasting a 20-pound turkey. I had to do some explaining to Luca about how much time it takes to roast a 20-pound turkey. I told him his birthday feast would probably be ready to eat at that rate around dawn the next day. He was destroyed. But what if we bought a very small turkey? A just-born turkey? I said, Luca, let's make it easy and have pizza, like every other good dysfunctional American family does on Thanksgiving. But he's still sad about it. Though there's a general sadness around Rome right now anyway. The weather has turned cold. The sanitation workers and the train employees and the national airline all went on strike on the same day. A study has just been released saying that 36% of Italian children have an allergy to the gluten needed to make pasta, pizza, and bread. So there goes Italian culture. Even worse, I recently saw an article with the shocking headline, Insoddisfatte sei donne su dieci, meaning that 6 out of 10 Italian women are sexually unsatisfied. Moreover, 35% of Italian men are reporting difficulty maintaining un'erezione, leaving researchers feeling very perplessi indeed, and making me wonder if sex should be allowed to be Rome's special word anymore after all. In more serious bad news, 19 Italian soldiers have recently been killed in the Americans' War, as it is called here, in Iraq, the largest number of military deaths in Italy since World War II. The Romans were shocked by these deaths, and the city closed down the day the boys were buried. The wide majority of Italians want nothing to do with George Bush's war. The involvement was the decision of Silvio Berlusconi, Italy's prime minister, more commonly referred to around these parts as l'idiota. This intellect-free, soccer-club-owning businessman, with his oily film of corruption and sleaze, who regularly embarrasses his fellow citizens by making lewd gestures in the European Parliament, who has mastered the art of speaking l'aria fritta, fried air, who expertly manipulates the media, not difficult when you own it, and who generally behaves not at all like a proper world leader, but rather like a Waterbury mayor. That's an inside joke for Connecticut residents only, sorry. Has now engaged the Italians in a war they see as none of their business whatsoever. They died for freedom, Berlusconi said at the funeral of the 19 Italian soldiers, but most Romans have a different opinion. They died for George Bush's personal vendetta. In this political climate, one might think it would be difficult to be a visiting American. Indeed, when I came to Italy, I expected to encounter a certain amount of resentment, but have received, instead, empathy from most Italians. In any reference to George Bush, people only nod to Berlusconi, saying, "We understand how it is. We have one, too. We've been there." It is odd, then, that Luca would want to use this birthday to celebrate an American Thanksgiving, given these circumstances. But I do like the idea of it. Thanksgiving is a nice holiday, something an American can freely be proud of, our one national festival that has remained relatively uncommodified. It's a day of grace and thanks and community and, yes, pleasure. It might be what we all need right now. My friend Deborah has come to Rome from Philadelphia for the weekend to celebrate the holiday with me. Deborah is an internationally respected psychologist, a writer, and a feminist theorist. But I still think of her as my favorite regular customer, back from the days when I was a diner waitress in Philadelphia, and she would come in for lunch and drink Diet Coke with no ice and say clever things to me over the counter. She really classed up that joint. We've been friends now for over 15 years. Sophie will be coming to Luca's party, too. Sophie and I have been friends for about 15 weeks. Everybody is always welcome on Thanksgiving, especially when it also happens to be Luca Spaghetti's birthday. We drive out of tired, stressed-out Rome late in the evening up into the mountains. Luca loves American music, so we're blasting the Eagles and singing, which adds an oddly Californian soundtrack to our drive through the olive groves and the ancient aqueducts. We arrive at the house of Luca's old friends Mario and Simona, parents of the twin 12-year-old girls Julia and Sarah. Paolo, a friend of Luca's whom I'd met before at soccer games, is there also, along with his girlfriend. Of course, Luca's own girlfriend, Juliana, is there as well, having driven up earlier in the evening. It's an exquisite house, hidden away in a grove of olive and clementine and lemon trees. The fireplace is lit. The olive oil is homemade. No time to roast a 20-pound turkey, obviously, but Luca sautés up some lovely cuts of turkey breast, and I preside over a whirlwind group effort to make a Thanksgiving stuffing, as best as I can remember the recipe, made from the crumbs of some high-end Italian bread, with the necessary cultural substitutions, dates instead of apricots, fennel instead of celery. Somehow, it comes out great. Luca had been worried about how the conversation would proceed tonight, given that half the guests can't speak English and the other half can't speak Italian, and only Sophie can speak Swedish. But it seems to be one of those miracle evenings where everyone can understand each other perfectly, or at least your neighbor can help translate when the odd word gets lost. I lose count of how many bottles of Sardinian wine we drink before Deborah introduces to the table the suggestion that we follow a nice American custom here tonight by joining hands and, each in turn, saying what we are most grateful for. In three languages, then, this montage of gratitude comes forth, one testimony at a time. Deborah starts by saying she is grateful that America will soon get a chance to pick a new president. Sophie says, first in Swedish, then in Italian, then in English, that she is grateful for the benevolent hearts of Italy, and for these 4 months she's been allowed to experience such pleasure in this country. The tears begin when Mario, our host, weeps in open gratitude as he thanks God for the work in his life that has enabled him to have this beautiful home for his family and friends to enjoy. Paolo gets a laugh when he says that he, too, is grateful that America will soon have the chance to elect a new president. We fall into a silence of collective respect for little Sarah, one of the 12-year-old twins, when she bravely shares that she is grateful to be here tonight with such nice people because she's been having a hard time at school lately. Some of the other students are being mean to her. So thank you for being sweet to me tonight and not mean to me like they are. Luca's girlfriend says she is grateful for the years of loyalty Luca has shown to her and for how warmly he has taken care of her family through difficult times. Simona, our hostess, cries even more openly than her husband had as she expresses her gratitude that a new custom of celebration and thankfulness has been brought into her home by these strangers from America who are not really strangers at all, but friends of Luca's and therefore friends of peace. When it comes my turn to speak, I begin, "Sono grata," but then I cannot say my real thoughts, namely that I am grateful to be free tonight from the depression that had been gnawing at me like a rat over the years, a depression that had chewed such perforations in my soul that I would not, at one time, have been able to enjoy even such a lovely night as this. I don't mention any of this because I don't want to alarm the children. Instead, I say a simpler truth, that I am grateful for old and new friends, that I am grateful most especially tonight for Luca Spaghetti, that I hope he has a happy 33rd birthday, and I hope he lives a long life in order to stand as an example to other men of how to be a generous, loyal, and loving human being. And that I hope nobody minds that I'm crying as I say all this, though I don't think they do mind, since everyone else is crying too. Luca is so clutched by emotion that he cannot find words except to say to all of us, "Your tears are my prayers." The Sardinian wine keeps on coming, and while Paolo washes the dishes, and Mario puts his tired daughters to bed, and Luca plays the guitar, and everyone sings drunken Neil Young songs in various accents, Deborah, the American feminist psychologist, says quietly to me, "Look around at these good Italian men. See how open they are to their feelings and how lovingly they participate in their families. See the regard and the respect they hold for the women and children in their lives. Don't believe what you read in the papers, Liz. This country is doing very well." Our party doesn't end until almost dawn. We could have roasted that 20-pound turkey after all and eaten it for breakfast. Luca Spaghetti drives me and Deborah and Sophie all the way back home. We try to help him stay awake as the sun comes up by singing Christmas carols. Silent night, sainted night, holy night, we sing over and over in every language we know as we all head back into Rome together. 35. I couldn't hold out. None of my pants, after almost 4 months in Italy, fit me anymore. Not even the new clothes I just bought last month, when I'd already outgrown my second month in Italy pants, fit me anymore. I can't afford to buy a new wardrobe every few weeks, and I am aware that I will soon be in India, where the pounds will just melt away. But still, I cannot walk in these pants anymore. I can't stand it. Which all makes sense, given that I recently stepped on a scale in a fancy Italian hotel and learned that I have gained 23 pounds in my 4 months in Italy, a truly admirable statistic. About 15 pounds of that I actually needed to gain because I had become so skeletal during these last hard years of divorce and depression. The next 5 pounds I just gained for fun. As for the final 3, just to prove a point, I suppose. But so it is that I find myself shopping for an item of clothing I will always keep in my life as a cherished souvenir, my last month in Italy jeans. The young lady in the shop is nice enough to keep bringing me bigger and bigger sizes, handing them through the curtain one after another without commentary, only asking with concern each time if this is closer to a fit. Several times I have needed to poke my head out of this curtain and ask, "Excuse me, do you have a pair that is slightly bigger?" Until the nice young lady finally gives me a pair of jeans with a waist measurement that verily hurts my eyes to witness, I step out of the dressing room, presenting myself to the salesgirl. She doesn't blink. She looks at me like an art curator trying to assess the value of a vase, a rather large vase. "Carina," she finally decides. "Cute." I ask her in Italian if she could please tell me honestly whether these genes are causing me to resemble a cow. No, signorina, I am told. You do not resemble a cow. Do I resemble a pig, then? No, she assures me with great seriousness. Nor do I resemble a pig in the least. Perhaps a buffalo? This is becoming good vocabulary practice. I'm also trying to get a smile out of the sales clerk, but she's too intent on remaining professional. I try one more time. Maybe I resemble a buffalo mozzarella? Okay, maybe, she concedes, smiling only slightly. Maybe you do look a little like a buffalo mozzarella. 36. I have only a week left here. I'm planning to go back to America for Christmas before flying to India. Not only because I can't stand the thought of spending Christmas without my family, but also because the next 8 months of my journey, India and Indonesia, require a complete repacking of gear. Very little of the stuff you need when you are living in Rome is the same stuff you need when you are wandering around India. And maybe it's in preparation for my trip to India that I decide to spend this last week traveling through Sicily, the most third-world section of Italy, and therefore not a bad place to go if you need to prepare yourself to experience extreme poverty. Or maybe I only want to go to Sicily because of what Goethe said. Without seeing Sicily, one cannot get a clear idea of what Italy is. But it's not easy getting to or around Sicily. I have to use all my finding out skills to find a train that runs on Sunday all the way down the coast, and then to find the correct ferry boat to Messina, a scary and suspicious Sicilian port town that seems to howl from behind barricaded doors. It's not my fault that I'm ugly. I've been earthquaked and carpet-bombed and raped by the mafia, too. Once I've arrived in Messina, I have to find a bus station, grimy as a smoker's lung, and find the man whose job it is to sit there in the ticket booth, mourning his life, and see if he will please sell me a ticket to the coastal town of Taormina. Then I rattle along the cliffs and beaches of Sicily's stupendous and hard-edged east coast until I get to Taormina. And then I have to find a taxi, and then I have to find a hotel. Then I have to find the right person of whom to ask my favorite question in Italian. Where is the best food in this town? In Taormina, that person turns out to be a sleepy policeman. He gives me one of the greatest things anyone can ever give me in life, a tiny piece of paper with the name of an obscure restaurant written on it, a hand-drawn map of how to find the place. Which turns out to be a little trattoria where the friendly, elderly proprietress is getting ready for her evening's customers by standing on a table in her stocking feet, trying not to knock over the Christmas creche as she polishes the restaurant windows. I tell her that I don't need to see the menu, but could she just bring me the best food possible because this is my first night in Sicily. She rubs her hands together in pleasure and yells something in Sicilian dialect to her even more elderly mother in the kitchen. And within the space of 20 minutes, I am busily eating the hands-down most amazing meal I've eaten yet in all of Italy. It's pasta, but a shape of pasta I've never before seen. Big, fresh sheets of pasta folded ravioli-like into the shape, if not exactly the size, of the Pope's hat, stuffed with a hot, aromatic puree of crustaceans and octopus and squid, served tossed like a hot salad with fresh cockles and strips of julienne vegetables, all swimming in an olivey, oceany broth, followed by the rabbit, stewed in thyme. But Siracusa the next day is even better. The bus coughs me up on a street corner here in the cold rain late in the day. I love this town immediately. There are 3,000 years of history under my feet in Siracusa. It's a place of such ancient civilization that it makes Rome look like Dallas. Myth says Daedalus flew here from Crete and that Hercules once slept here. Siracusa was a Greek colony that Thucydides called a city not in the least inferior to Athens itself. Siracusa is the link between ancient Greece and ancient Rome. Many great playwrights and scientists of antiquity lived here. Plato thought it would be the ideal location for a utopian experiment where, perhaps by some divine fate, rulers might become philosophers, and philosophers might become rulers. Historians say that rhetoric was invented in Siracusa, and also, and this is just a minor thing, plot. I walk through the markets of this crumbly town, and my heart tumbles with a love I can't answer or explain as I watch an old guy in a black wool hat gut a fish for a customer. He has stuck his cigarette in his lips for safekeeping, the way a seamstress keeps her pins in her mouth as she sews. His knife works with devotional perfection on the fillets. Shyly, I ask this fisherman where I should eat tonight, and I leave our conversation clutching yet another little piece of paper, directing me to a little restaurant with no name, where, as soon as I sit down that night, the waiter brings me airy clouds of ricotta sprinkled with pistachio, bread chunks floating in aromatic oils, tiny plates of sliced meats and olives, a salad of chilled oranges tossed in a dressing of raw onion and parsley. And this is before I even hear about the Calamari House special. No town can live peacefully, whatever its laws, Plato wrote, when its citizens do nothing but feast and drink and tire themselves out in the cares of love. But is it such a bad thing to live like this for just a little while? Just for a few months of one's life, is it so awful to travel through time with no greater ambition than to find the next lovely meal? Or to learn how to speak a language for no higher purpose than that it pleases your ear to hear it? Or to nap in a garden in a patch of sunlight in the middle of the day, right next to your favorite fountain, and then do it again the next day? Of course, one can't live like this forever. Real life and wars and traumas and mortality will interfere eventually. Here in Sicily, with its dreadful poverty, real life is never far from anyone's mind. The mafia has been the only successful business in Sicily for centuries, running the business of protecting citizens from itself, and it still keeps its hand down everybody's pants. Palermo, a city Goethe once claimed was possessed of an impossible-to-describe beauty, may now be the only city in Western Europe where you can still find yourself picking your steps through World War II rubble, just to give a sense of development here. The town has been systematically uglified beyond description by the hideous and unsafe apartment blocks the mafia constructed in the 1980s as money laundering operations. I asked one Sicilian if these buildings were made from cheap concrete, and he said, "Oh no, this is very expensive concrete. In each batch there are a few bodies of people who were killed by the mafia, and that costs money. But it does make the concrete stronger to be reinforced with all those bones and teeth." In such an environment, is it maybe a little shallow to be thinking only about your next wonderful meal? Or is it perhaps the best you can do, given the harder realities? Luigi Barzini, in his 1964 masterwork, The Italians, written when he'd finally grown tired of foreigners writing about Italy and either loving it or hating it too much, tried to set the record straight on his own culture. He tried to answer the question of why the Italians have produced the greatest artistic, political, and scientific minds of the ages, but have still never become a major world power. Why are they the planet's masters of verbal diplomacy, but still so inept at home government? Why are they so individually valiant, yet so collectively unsuccessful as an army? How can they be such shrewd merchants on the personal level, yet such inefficient capitalists as a nation? His answers to these questions are much more complex than I can fairly encapsulate here, but have much to do with a sad Italian history of corruption by local leaders and exploitation by foreign dominators, all of which has generally led Italians to draw the seemingly accurate conclusion that nobody and nothing in this world can be trusted. Because the world is so corrupted, misspoken, unstable, exaggerated, and unfair, one should trust only what one can experience with one's senses. And this makes the senses stronger in Italy than anywhere in Europe. This is why, Barzini says, Italians will tolerate hideously incompetent generals, presidents, tyrants, professors, bureaucrats, journalists, and captains of industry, but will never tolerate incompetent opera singers, conductors, ballerinas, courtesans, actors, film directors, cooks, tailors. In a world of disorder and disaster and fraud, sometimes only beauty can be trusted. Only artistic excellence is incorruptible. Pleasure cannot be bargained down. And sometimes the meal is the only currency that is real. To devote yourself to the creation and enjoyment of beauty, then, can be a serious business. Not necessarily a means of escaping reality, but sometimes a means of holding on to the real when everything else is flaking away into rhetoric and plot. Not too long ago, authorities arrested a brotherhood of Catholic monks in Sicily who were in tight conspiracy with the mafia. So who can you trust? What can you believe? The world is unkind and unfair. Speak up against this unfairness, and in Sicily, at least, you'll end up as the foundation of an ugly new building. What can you do in such an environment to hold on to a sense of your individual human dignity? Maybe nothing. Maybe nothing except, perhaps, to pride yourself on the fact that you always fillet your fish with perfection, or that you make the lightest ricotta in the whole town. I don't want to insult anybody by drawing too much of a comparison between myself and the long-suffering Sicilian people. The tragedies in my life have been of a personal and largely self-created nature, not epically oppressive. I went through a divorce and a depression, not a few centuries of murderous tyranny. I had a crisis of identity, but I also had the resources, financial, artistic, and emotional, with which to try to work it out. Still, I will say that the same thing which has helped generations of Sicilians hold their dignity has helped me begin to recover mine, namely, the idea that the appreciation of pleasure can be an anchor of one's humanity. I believe this is what Goethe meant when he said that you have to come here to Sicily in order to understand Italy. And I suppose this is what I instinctively felt when I decided that I needed to come here, to Italy, in order to understand myself. It was in a bathtub back in New York, reading Italian words aloud from a dictionary, that I first started mending my soul. My life had gone to bits, and I was so unrecognizable to myself that I probably couldn't have picked me out of a police lineup. But I felt a glimmer of happiness when I started studying Italian, and when you sense a faint potentiality for happiness after such dark times, you must grab onto the ankles of that happiness and not let go until it drags you face first out of the dirt. This is not selfishness, but obligation. You are given life. It is your duty, and also your entitlement as a human being, to find something beautiful within life, no matter how slight. I came to Italy pinched and thin. I did not know yet what I deserved. I still maybe don't fully know what I deserve. But I do know that I have collected myself of late through the enjoyment of harmless pleasures into somebody much more intact. The easiest, most fundamentally human way to say it is that I have put on weight. I exist more now than I did 4 months ago. I will leave Italy noticeably bigger than when I arrived here. And I will leave with the hope that the expansion of one person, the magnification of one life, is indeed an act of worth in this world. Even if that life, just this one time, happens to be nobody's but my own. Book 2. India. Or, Congratulations to Meet You. Or, 36 Tales About the Pursuit of Devotion. 37. When I was growing up, my family kept chickens. We always had about a dozen of them at any given time, and whenever one died off, taken away by hawk or fox or by some obscure chicken illness, my father would replace the lost hen. He'd drive to a nearby poultry farm and return with a new chicken in a sack. The thing is, you must be very careful when introducing a new chicken to the general flock. You can't just toss it in there with the old chickens, or they will see it as an invader. What you must do instead is to slip the new bird into the chicken coop in the middle of the night while the others are asleep. Place her on a roost beside the flock and tiptoe away. In the morning, when the chickens wake up, they don't notice the newcomer, thinking only, "She must have been here all the time since I didn't see her arrive." The clincher of it is, awaking within this flock, the newcomer herself doesn't even remember that she's a newcomer, thinking only, "I must have been here the whole time." This is exactly how I arrive in India. My plane lands in Mumbai around 1:30 a.m. It is December 30th. I find my luggage, then find the taxi that will take me hours and hours out of the city to the ashram, located in a remote rural village. I doze on the drive through nighttime India, sometimes waking to look out the window, where I see strange, haunted shapes of thin women in saris walking alongside the road with bundles of firewood on their heads. At this hour? Buses with no headlights pass us, and we pass ox carts. The banyan trees spread their elegant roots throughout the ditches. We pull up to the front gate of the ashram at 3:30 a.m., right in front of the temple. As I'm getting out of the taxi, a young man in Western clothes and a wool hat steps out of the shadows and introduces himself. He is Arturo, a 24-year-old journalist from Mexico and a devotee of my guru, and he's here to welcome me. As we're exchanging whispered introductions, I can hear the first familiar bars of my favorite Sanskrit hymn coming from inside. It's the morning arati, the first morning prayer, sung every day at 3:30 a.m. as the ashram wakes. I point to the temple, asking Arturo, "May I?" And he makes a be-my-guest gesture. So I pay my taxi driver, tuck my backpack behind a tree, slip off my shoes, kneel, and touch my forehead to the temple step, and then ease myself inside, joining the small gathering of mostly Indian women who are singing this beautiful hymn. This is the hymn I call The Amazing Grace of Sanskrit, filled with devotional longing. It is the one devotional song I have memorized, not so much from effort as from love. I begin to sing the familiar words in Sanskrit, from the simple introduction about the sacred teachings of yoga to the rising tones of worship. I adore the cause of the universe. I adore the one whose eyes are the sun, the moon, and the fire. You are everything to me, O God of gods. To the last gem-like summation of all faith. This is perfect. That is perfect. If you take the perfect from the perfect remains. The women finish singing. They bow in silence, then move out a side door across a dark courtyard and into a smaller temple, barely lit by one oil lamp and perfumed with incense. I follow them. The room is filled with devotees, Indian and Western, wrapped in woolen shawls against the pre-dawn cold. Everyone is seated in meditation, roosted there, you might say, and I slip in beside them, the new bird in the flock, completely unnoticed. I sit cross-legged, place my hands on my knees, close my eyes. I have not meditated in 4 months. I have not even thought about meditating in 4 months. I sit there. My breath quiets. I say the mantra to myself once very slowly and deliberately, syllable by syllable. Om Namah Shivaya. Om Namah Shivaya. I honor the divinity that resides within me. Then I repeat it again, again, and again. It's not so much that I'm meditating as unpacking the mantra carefully, the way you would unpack your grandmother's best china if it had been stored in a box for a long time, unused. I don't know if I fall asleep, or if I drop into some kind of spell, or even how much time passes. But when the sun finally comes up that morning in India, and everyone opens their eyes and looks around, Italy feels 10,000 miles away from me now, and it is as if I have been here in this flock forever. 38. Why do we practice yoga? I had a teacher once ask that question during a particularly challenging yoga class back in New York. We were all bent into these exhausting sideways triangles, and the teacher was making us hold the position longer than any of us would have liked. "Why do we practice yoga?" he asked again. "Is it so we can become a little bendier than our neighbors? Or is there perhaps some higher purpose?" Yoga, in Sanskrit, can be translated as union. It originally comes from the root word yuj, which means to yoke, to attach yourself to a task at hand with ox-like discipline. And the task at hand in yoga is to find union between mind and body, between the individual and her God, between our thoughts and the source of our thoughts, between teacher and student, and even between ourselves and our sometimes hard-to-bend neighbors. In the West, we've mainly come to know yoga through its now famous pretzel-like exercises for the body, but this is only hatha yoga, one limb of the philosophy. The ancients developed these physical stretches not for personal fitness, but to loosen up their muscles and minds in order to prepare them for meditation. It is difficult to sit in stillness for many hours, after all, if your hip is aching, keeping you from contemplating your intrinsic divinity because you're too busy contemplating, "Wow, my hip really aches." But yoga can also mean trying to find God through meditation, through scholarly study, through the practice of silence, through devotional service, or through mantra, the repetition of sacred words in Sanskrit. While some of these practices tend to look rather Hindu in their derivation, yoga is not synonymous with Hinduism, nor are all Hindus yogis. True yoga neither competes with nor precludes any other religion. You may use your yoga, your disciplined practices of sacred union, to get closer to Krishna, Jesus, Muhammad, Buddha, or Yahweh. During my time at the ashram, I met devotees who identified themselves as practicing Christians, Jews, Buddhists, Hindus, and even Muslims. I have met others who would rather not talk about their religious affiliation at all, for which, in this contentious world, you can hardly blame them. The yogic path is about disentangling the built-in glitches of the human condition, which I'm going to oversimply define here as the heartbreaking inability to sustain contentment. Different schools of thought over the centuries have found different explanations for man's apparently inherently flawed state. Taoists call it imbalance. Buddhism calls it ignorance. Islam blames our misery on rebellion against God. And the Judeo-Christian tradition attributes all our suffering to original sin. Freudians say that unhappiness is the inevitable result of the clash between our natural drives and civilization's needs. As my friend Deborah the psychologist explains it, desire is the design flaw. The yogis, however, say that human discontentment is a simple case of mistaken identity. We're miserable because we think that we are mere individuals, alone with our fears and flaws and resentments and mortality. We wrongly believe that our limited little egos constitute our whole entire nature. We have failed to recognize our deeper divine character. We don't realize that somewhere within all of us, there does exist a supreme self who is eternally at peace. That supreme self is our true identity, universal and divine. Before you realize this truth, say the yogis, you will always be in despair. A notion nicely expressed in this exasperated line from the Greek Stoic philosopher Epictetus, "You bear God within you, poor wretch, and know it not." Yoga is the effort to experience one's divinity personally and then to hold on to that experience forever. Yoga is about self-mastery, and the dedicated effort to haul your attention away from your endless brooding over the past and your nonstop worrying about the future so that you can seek instead a place of eternal presence from which you may regard yourself and your surroundings with poise. Only from that point of even-mindedness will the true nature of the world and yourself be revealed to you. True yogis, from their seat of equipoise, see all this world as an equal manifestation of God's creative energy. Men, women, children, turnips, bedbugs, coral, it's all God in disguise. But the yogis believe a human life is a very special opportunity, because only in a human form, and only with a human mind, can God realization ever occur. The turnips, the bedbugs, the coral, they never get a chance to find out who they really are. But we do have that chance. "Our whole business, therefore, in this life," wrote St. Augustine, rather yogically, "is to restore to health the eye of the heart whereby God may be seen." Like all great philosophical ideas, this one is simple to understand but virtually impossible to imbibe. Okay, so we are all one and divinity abides within us all equally. No problem. Understood. But now try living from that place. Try putting that understanding into practice 24 hours a day. It's not so easy. Which is why in India it is considered a given that you need a teacher for your yoga. Unless you were born one of those rare, shimmering saints who come into life already fully actualized, you're going to need some guidance along your journey toward enlightenment. If you're lucky enough, you will find a living guru. This is what pilgrims have been coming to India to seek for ages. Alexander the Great sent an ambassador to India in the 4th century BC with a request to find one of these famous yogis and return with him to court. The ambassador did report finding a yogi, but couldn't convince the gentleman to travel. In the 1st century AD, Apollonius of Tirana, another Greek ambassador, wrote of his journey through India, "I saw Indian Brahmins living upon the earth and yet not on it, and fortified without fortifications, and possessing nothing, yet having the richness of all men." Gandhi himself always wanted to study with a guru, but never to his regret had the opportunity or time to find one. "I think there is a great deal of truth," he wrote, "in the doctrine that true knowledge is impossible without a guru." A great yogi is anyone who has achieved the permanent state of enlightened bliss. A guru is a great yogi who can actually pass that state on to others. The word guru is composed of two Sanskrit syllables. The first means darkness. The second means light. Out of the darkness and into the light. What passes from the master into the disciple is something called mantravirya, the potency of the enlightened consciousness. You come to your guru, then, not only to receive lessons as from any teacher, but to actually receive the guru's state of grace. Such transfers of grace can occur even in the most fleeting of encounters with a great being. I once went to see the great Vietnamese monk, poet, and peacemaker Thich Nhat Hanh speak in New York. It was a characteristically hectic weeknight in the city, and as the crowd pushed and shoved its way into the auditorium, the very air in the place was whisked into a nerve-wracking urgency of everyone's collective stress. Then the monk came on stage. He sat in stillness for a good while before he began to speak, and the audience, you could feel it happening, one row of high-strung New Yorkers at a time, became colonized by his stillness. Soon, there was not a flutter in the place. In the space of maybe 10 minutes, this small Vietnamese man had drawn every single one of us into his silence. Or maybe it's more accurate to say that he drew us each into our own silence, into that peace which we each inherently possessed, but had not yet discovered or claimed. His ability to bring forth this state in all of us, merely by his presence in the room, this is divine power. And this is why you come to a guru, with the hope that the merits of your master will reveal to you your own hidden greatness. The classical Indian sages wrote that there are three factors which indicate whether a soul has been blessed with the highest and most auspicious luck in the universe. One, to have been born a human being, capable of conscious inquiry. Two, to have been born with, or to have developed, a yearning to understand the nature of the universe. Three, to have found a living spiritual master. There is a theory that if you yearn sincerely enough for a guru, you will find one. The universe will shift, destiny's molecules will get themselves organized, and your path will soon intersect with the path of the master you need. It was only 1 month after my first night of desperate prayer on the bathroom floor, a night spent tearfully begging God for answers, that I found mine. Having walked into David's apartment and encountered a photograph of this stunning Indian woman. Of course, I was more than a bit ambivalent about the concept of having a guru. As a general rule, Westerners aren't comfortable with that word. We have a kind of sketchy recent history with it. In the 1970s, a number of wealthy, eager, susceptible young Western seekers collided with a handful of charismatic but dubious Indian gurus. Most of the chaos has settled down now, but the echoes of mistrust still resonate. Even for me, even after all this time, I still find myself sometimes balking at the word guru. This is not a problem for my friends in India. They grew up with the guru principle. They're relaxed with it. As one Indian girl told me, everybody in India almost has a guru. I know what she meant to say, that almost everybody in India has a guru, but I relate more to her unintentional statement, because that's how I feel sometimes, like I almost have a guru. Sometimes I just can't seem to admit it because, as a good New Englander, skepticism and pragmatism are my intellectual heritage. Anyhow, it's not like I consciously went shopping for a guru. She just arrived. And the first time I saw her, it was as though she looked at me through her photograph, those dark eyes smoldering with intelligent compassion, and she said, "You called for me, and now I'm here. So do you want to do this thing or not?" Setting aside all nervous jokes and cross-cultural discomforts, I must always remember what I replied that night. A straightforward and bottomless yes. 39. One of my first roommates at the ashram was a middle-aged African-American devout Baptist and meditation instructor from South Carolina. My other roommates over time would include an Argentinian dancer, a Swiss homeopath, a Mexican secretary, an Australian mother of five, a young Bangladeshi computer programmer, a pediatrician from Maine, and a Filipino accountant. Others would come and go too, as devotees cycled in and out of their residency. This ashram is not a place you can casually drop by and visit. First of all, it's not wildly accessible. It's located far away from Mumbai, on a dirt road in a rural river valley near a pretty and scrappy little village, composed of one street, one temple, a handful of shops, and a population of cows who wander about freely, sometimes walking into the tailor's shop and lying down there. One evening I noticed a naked 60-watt light bulb hanging from a wire on a tree in the middle of town. This is the town's one street lamp. The ashram essentially creates the local economy, such as it is, and also stands as the town's pride. Outside the walls of the ashram, it is all dust and poverty. Inside, it's all irrigated gardens, beds of flowers, hidden orchids, birdsong, mango trees, jackfruit trees, cashew trees, palm trees, magnolias, banyans. The buildings are nice, though not extravagant. There's a simple dining hall, cafeteria style. There's a comprehensive library of spiritual writings from the world's religious traditions. There are a few temples for different types of gatherings. There are two meditation caves, dark and silent basements with comfortable cushions, open all day and night to be used only for meditation practice. There's a covered outdoor pavilion where yoga classes are held in the morning, and there's a kind of a park with an oval walking path around it where students can jog for exercise. I'm sleeping in a concrete dormitory. During my stay at the ashram, there were never more than a few hundred residents at any time. If the guru herself had been in residence, those numbers would have swollen considerably, but she was never in India when I was there. I'd sort of expected that. She'd been spending a fair bit of time lately in America, but you never knew when she might show up anywhere by surprise. It's not considered essential to be in her literal presence in order to keep up your studies with her. There is, of course, the irreplaceable high of actually being around a living yogic master, and I've experienced that before. But many long-time devotees agree that it can also sometimes be a distraction. If you're not careful, you can get all caught up in the celebrity buzz of excitement that surrounds the guru and lose focus of your true intention. Whereas, if you just go to one of her ashrams and discipline yourself to keep to the austere schedule of practices, you will sometimes find that it is easier to communicate with your teacher from within these private meditations than to push your way through crowds of eager students and get a word in edgewise in person. There are some long-term paid staffers at the ashram, but most of the work here is done by the students themselves. Some of the local villagers also work here on salary. Other locals are devotees of the guru and live here as students. One teenage Indian boy around the ashram somehow really provoked my fascination. There was something about his, pardon the word, but aura, that was so compelling to me. For one thing, he was incredibly skinny. Though this is a fairly typical sight around here. If there's anything in this world skinnier than an Indian teenage boy, I'd be afraid to see it. He dressed the way the computer-interested boys in my junior high school used to dress for band concerts. Dark trousers and an ironed white button-down shirt that was far too big for him, his thin, stem-like neck sticking out of the opening like a single daisy popping out of a giant flower pot. His hair was always combed neatly with water. He wore an older man's belt, wrapped almost twice around what had to be a 16-inch waist. He wore the same clothes every day. This was his only outfit, I realized. He must have been washing his shirt by hand every night and ironing it in the mornings. Though this attention to polite dress is also typical around here, the Indian teenagers with their starched outfits quickly shamed me out of my wrinkled peasant dresses and put me into tidier, more modest clothes. So what was it about this kid? Why was I so moved every time I saw his face, a face so drenched with luminescence it looked like he'd just come back from a long vacation in the Milky Way? I finally asked another Indian teenager who he was. She replied, matter-of-factly, "This is the son of one of the local shopkeepers. His family is very poor. The guru invited him to stay here. When he plays the drums, you can hear God's voice." There is one temple in the ashram that is open to the general public, where many Indians come throughout the day to pay tribute to a statue of the Siddha Yogi, or perfected master, who established this lineage of teaching back in the 1920s, and who is still revered across India as a great saint. But the rest of the ashram is for students only. It's not a hotel or a tourist location. It's more like a university. You must apply to come here. And in order to be accepted for residency, you must show that you've been studying this yoga seriously for a good long while. A minimum stay of 1 month is required. I've decided to stay here for 6 weeks, and then to travel around India on my own, exploring other temples, ashrams, and devotional sites. The students here are about equally divided between Indians and Westerners, and the Westerners are about equally divided between Americans and Europeans. Courses are taught in both Hindi and English. On your application, you must write an essay, gather references, and answer questions about your mental and physical health, about any history of drug or alcohol abuse, and also about your financial stability. The guru doesn't want people to use her ashram as an escape from whatever bedlam they may have created in their real lives. This will not benefit anyone. She also has a general policy that if your family and loved ones for some reason deeply object to the idea of your following a guru and living in an ashram, then you shouldn't do it. It's not worth it. Just stay home in your normal life and be a good person. There's no reason to make a big dramatic production over this. The level of this woman's practical sensibilities are always so comforting to me. To come here, then, you must demonstrate that you are also a sensible and practical human being. You must show that you can work, because you'll be expected to contribute to the overall operation of the place, with about 5 hours a day of seva, or selfless service. The ashram management also asks if you have gone through a major emotional trauma in the last 6 months, divorce, death in the family, that you please postpone your visit to another time, because chances are you won't be able to concentrate on your studies, and if you have a meltdown of some sort, you'll only bring distraction to your fellow students. I just made the post-divorce cutoff myself. And when I think of the mental anguish I was going through right after I left my marriage, I have no doubt that I would have been a great drain on everyone at this ashram had I come here at that moment. Far better to have rested first in Italy, gotten my strength and health back, and then showed up. Because I will need that strength now. They want you to come here strong because ashram life is rigorous. Not just physically, with days that begin at 3 a.m. and end at 9 p.m., but also psychologically. You're going to be spending hours and hours a day in silent meditation and contemplation, with little distraction or relief from the apparatus of your own mind. You will be living in close quarters with strangers in rural India. There are bugs and snakes and rodents. The weather can be extreme, sometimes torrents of rain for weeks on end, sometimes 100 degrees in the shade before breakfast. Things can get deeply real around here, very fast. My guru always says that only one thing will happen when you come to the ashram, that you will discover who you really are. So if you're hovering on the brink of madness already, she'd really rather you didn't come at all. Because frankly, nobody wants to have to carry you out of this place with a wooden spoon clenched between your teeth. 40. My arrival coincides nicely with the arrival of a new year. I have barely one day to get myself oriented to the ashram, and then it's already New Year's Eve. After dinner, the small courtyard starts to fill with people. We all sit on the ground, some of us on the cool marble floor, and some on grass mats. The Indian women have all dressed as though for a wedding. Their hair is oiled and dark and braided down their backs. They are wearing their finest silk saris and gold bracelets, and each woman has a brightly jeweled bindi in the center of her forehead, like a dim echo of the starlight above us. The plan is to chant outside in this courtyard until midnight, until the year changes over. Chanting is a word I do not love for a practice that I love dearly. To me, the word chant connotes a kind of drone-like and scary monotony, like something male druids would do around a sacrificial fire. But when we chant here at the ashram, it's a kind of angelic singing. Generally, it's done in a call-and-response manner. A handful of young men and women with the loveliest voices begin by singing one harmonious phrase, and the rest of us repeat it. It's a meditative practice. The effort is to hold your attention on the music's progression and blend your voice together with your neighbor's voice so that eventually all are singing as one. I'm jet-lagged and afraid it will be impossible for me to stay awake until midnight, much less to find the energy to sing for so long. But then this evening of music begins with a single violin in the shadows playing one long note of longing. Then comes the harmonium, then the slow drums, then the voices. I'm sitting in the back of the courtyard with all the mothers, the Indian women who are so comfortably cross-legged, their children sleeping across them like little human lap rugs. The chant tonight is a lullaby, a lament, an attempt at gratitude, written in a raga, a tune, that is meant to suggest compassion and devotion. We are singing in Sanskrit, as always, an ancient language that is extinct in India, except for prayer and religious study. And I'm trying to become a vocal mirror for the voices of the lead singers, picking up their inflections like little strings of blue light. They pass the sacred words to me, I carry the words for a while, then pass the words back, and this is how we are able to sing for miles and miles of time without tiring. All of us are swaying like kelp in the dark sea current of night. The children around me are wrapped in silks like gifts. I'm so tired, but I don't drop my little blue string of song. And I drift into such a state that I think I might be calling God's name in my sleep, or maybe I am only falling down the well shaft of this universe. By 11:30, though, the orchestra has picked up the tempo of the chant and kicked it up into sheer joy. Beautifully dressed women in jingly bracelets are clapping and dancing and attempting to tambourine with their whole bodies. The drums are slamming, rhythmic, exciting. As the minutes pass, it feels to me like we are collectively pulling the year 2004 toward us, like we have roped it with our music, and now we are hauling it across the night sky like it's a massive fishing net, brimming with all of our unknown destinies. And what a heavy net it is indeed, carrying as it does all the births, deaths, tragedies, wars, love stories, inventions, transformations, and calamities that are destined for all of us this coming year. We keep singing, and we keep hauling, hand over hand, minute by minute, voice after voice, closer and closer. The seconds drop down to midnight, and we sing with our biggest effort yet. And in this last brave exertion, we finally pull the net of the new year over us, covering both the sky and ourselves with it. God only knows what the year might contain, but now it is here, and we are all beneath it. This is the first New Year's Eve I can ever remember in my life where I haven't known any of the people I was celebrating with. In all this dancing and singing, there is nobody for me to embrace at midnight. But I wouldn't say that anything about this night has been lonely. No, I would definitely not say that. 41. We are all given work here, and it turns out that my work assignment is to scrub the temple floors. So that's where you can find me for several hours a day now, down on my knees on the cold marble with a brush and a bucket, working away like a fairy tale stepsister. By the way, I'm aware of the metaphor, the scrubbing clean of the temple that is my heart, the polishing of my soul, the everyday mundane effort that must be applied to spiritual practice in order to purify the self, etc., etc. My fellow floor scrubbers are mainly a bunch of Indian teenagers. They always give teenagers this job because it requires high physical energy, but not enormous reserves of responsibility. There's a limit to how much damage you can do if you mess up. I like my coworkers. The girls are fluttery little butterflies who seem so much younger than American 18-year-old girls. And the boys are serious little autocrats who seem so much older than American 18-year-old boys. Nobody's supposed to talk in the temples, but these are teenagers, so there's a constant chatter going on all the time as we're working. It's not all idle gossip. One of the boys spends all day scrubbing beside me, lecturing me earnestly on how to best perform my work here. Take seriously. Make punctual. Be cool and easy. Remember, everything you do for God, and everything God does, he do for you. It's tiring physical labor, but my daily hours of work are considerably easier than my daily hours of meditation. The truth is, I don't think I'm good at meditation. I know I'm out of practice with it, but honestly, I was never good at it. I can't seem to get my mind to hold still. I mentioned this once to an Indian monk, and he said, "It's a pity you're the only person in the history of the world who ever had this problem." Then the monk quoted to me from the Bhagavad Gita, the most sacred ancient text of yoga, "O Krishna, the mind is restless, turbulent, strong, and unyielding. I consider it as difficult to subdue as the wind." Meditation is both the anchor and the wings of yoga. Meditation is the way. There's a difference between meditation and prayer, though both practices seek communion with the divine. I've heard it said that prayer is the act of talking to God, while meditation is the act of listening. Take a wild guess as to which comes easier for me. I can prattle away to God about my feelings and my problems all the livelong day, but when it comes time to descend into silence and listen, well, that's a different story. When I ask my mind to rest in stillness, it is astonishing how quickly it will turn 1. Bored, 2. Angry, 3. Depressed, 4. Anxious, or 5. All of the above.